favorable to politics as a means of giving people exactly what they wanted. That notion is a rather new idea.
Behind these new ideas about how society should be managed was a model of the individual as a rational, calculating machine whose self-interested behaviour could be analysed by numbers. This simplified version of us had been created back in the Cold War by game theorists. They had made an assumption that we were like that, simply in order to make their equations and their models work. But what was now rising up was a powerful scientific proof that this was not just an assumption. It really did describe the very roots of our nature. That everything human beings did and felt had been programmed into us by our gene. And all our actions were the result of rational calculations by that genetic program. That we really were computing machines guided by numbers. The roots of this idea go back to the early 1970s, when geneticists who were studying the behaviour of animals made a conceptual shift. They started to look at the animal's behaviour from what was called the gene's point of view. And they realised that from this perspective, the animals were simply machines that were being used by the genes to survive and replicate themselves.
In effect, we can picture the body of the chicken as being a machine, a device, constructed by the genes to ensure the production of more genes. Now, this may seem a perverse way of looking at things. You may think of reproduction as your method of producing children like yourself. And I'm asking you to look at it in a very different light. The body is simply the genes' device for producing more genes like itself.
Behind this new way of seeing animals was yet again game theory. Game theory had inspired the geneticists because it gave a powerful framework for understanding how the genes dictated behaviour. Game theorists looked at society as a system of self-interested individuals competing and strategising against one another. And the geneticists applied exactly the same model to genes. They developed complicated equations to show how all animal behaviour, from violence to altruism, actually rational strategies played by the genes in a game of survival. The geneticists asserted that the same must be true for human beings. And one scientist did an extraordinary experiment to see whether our genes did control our behaviour in the same rational, mathematical way. It took place deep within the Amazon forests. The Yanomamo people were famous for being one of the most violent societies on Earth. An anthropologist studying them decided to see whether behind the chaos of the fighting there was a hidden genetic pattern guiding it in a mathematical way. He was called Napoleon Chagnon, and his first step was to try and find out the names of everyone and who was related to whom.
I assumed at the outset that the natives would be excited and eager and thrilled and flattered that I was interested in their culture and their society and in their families and genealogies. And so I would innocently ask what the name of so-and-so was, and they would give me a name, and I'd write it down. And it turned out that they tricked me, that all of the names that the people in the village I was living in were not only incorrect, but they were derogatory, vulgar, false. Not all of them were vulgar and derogatory, but a lot of them were.
Like what?
Like fart breath, hairy c*** and long dong. Things of that sort. Hairy pussy, as the name of the wife of the headman.
But Chagnon persisted. He spent months checking and cross-checking names and relationships. He also gave out Western goods, above all the prize machete, in return for information, until he had built up what he believed was an accurate database of the names and genealogies of 6,000 Yanomami, which he then stored on a computer at his university. Chagnon then returned with a film crew and recorded in great detail a fight in a village.
Bring your camera over here.
Channel returned to America and went through the film frame by frame, identifying all the participants. On the surface, there seemed no meaning to the fight. Often individuals who appeared closely related attacked each other. But when Chagnon fed their details into the computer and cross-checked them with his database, another reality emerged. Because of the Yanomamo's complex history of intermarriage, individuals were related to each other in the most surprising ways. And what the computer showed was that the individuals who took risks for each other in the fight were always more closely genetically related than those they attacked.
There was a hidden pattern in the film, and it was the computer that proved and demonstrated that the pattern was there, because you can't possibly remember everybody's genealogical relatedness to everybody else in the village. So underneath all of this chaos and confusion and what meets the eye, there were people who shared genes with each other and chose sides on the basis of their relatedness to each other. Yeah, there's kind of a hidden mathematical dimension to the whole thing that you have to really dig for to discover.
Chagnon's experiment caused a sensation within the human sciences, because it seemed to offer precise mathematical proof that genes played a powerful role in guiding human behaviour. It became one of the fundamental pieces of evidence underpinning a new, powerful model of human beings. They were machines whose actions and feelings were driven by coded instructions implanted deep inside them millions of years ago, of which they were unaware. It was an image that began to permeate deep into our culture.
The image of the organism, including ourselves, as a machine for passing on genes, to shift the focus away from the idea of the organism as being the agent in life, to the immortal replicator.
Our DNA is a coded description of the worlds in which our ancestors survived.
DNA. It's the computer recipe for life itself, unraveling like a reel of magnetic tape on some giant computer.
Back in the dark and frightening days of the Cold War, mathematicians had developed a simplified, machine-like model of human beings whose behaviour could be analysed and predicted by numbers. They had done this to try and understand and control the terrifying uncertainties of that time. Now in the 1990s, the Cold War was over and its giant defences lay empty. But that simplified model had risen up and triumphed as an explanation of what we truly are as human beings, on every level, politically, economically, and now biologically.
We no longer see this theory as having historical inspiration in the Cold War. Instead, what we see it as a kind of quasi-natural social science theory of everything. It applies to something as small as a gene, or something as medium-sized as a human being, or something as large as a nation-state. The human being sort of dissolves in this social theory, that it isn't about necessarily human beings anymore. It's about these little entities that are constantly questing to reproduce themselves and also find their maximum advantage.
And with the rise of this machine model of human beings, a new idea of how to change society began to emerge. Not through politics any longer, but by adjusting how well the individual machines functioned. The technicians of this new idea would be the psychiatrists and the drug companies who would free people from the terrible anxieties inside themselves. But what it would lead to would be a new form of order and control, not defined by the old political elites, by the objective power of numbers.
I just found myself constantly worrying. I just couldn't stop.
My hands were shaking, and I was sure that people were looking at me and watching my hands.
These college students didn't know it then, but they were each experiencing the symptoms of an anxiety disorder.
panic disorder, generalized anxiety disorder, obsessive-compulsive disorder, social phobia, and post-traumatic stress disorder.
This year, 23 million Americans will suffer from one of these anxiety disorders. They're the most common mental illness in the country, and they can attack anyone at any time.
In the early 90s, an epidemic of mental disorder was sweeping America and Britain. As last week's program showed, it had been uncovered by a new system for identifying disorders. Psychiatry had been attacked for relying on the personal and fallible judgment of psychiatrists. And instead, a new objective method based on checklists had been invented. These listed only the objective symptoms and deliberately did not inquire into why individuals felt an anxiety. In the late 80s, nationwide surveys had revealed an incredible picture. More than 50% of Americans suffered from mental disorders.
What do you feel? I don't know, I'm just sad.
But at the very same time, the drug companies had announced that they had created a new type of drug called an SSRI, which they claimed targeted the circuits inside the brain that were causing these malfunctions. The SSRIs were marketed under names like Prozac. What they did was alter the amounts of serotonin that flowed across the circuit connections within the brain, and they readjusted the chemicals to normal levels.
And then all of a sudden, here comes somebody that says, okay, now try these on, try this Prozac on. And I tried it on, and for the first time in my life, I went, whoa, is this the way reality really is?
This pill could solve all of your problems. It's called Prozac, and it may mean the end of depression as we know it.
I've been taking Prozac for 2 years.
And what difference has that made?
Brilliant.
Oh, she's smiling, eyes lighter.
And I feel as if I'm back to normal.
You feel normal?
Yeah.
And you feel a better person?
Yeah, yeah.
Through treatment, I learned to function with my disorder, and now life is so much more enjoyable.
Life is so much better now that I've gotten treatment, and I feel like I've got my OCD under control, and it feels really great.
A better life is waiting.
What now began to happen was that millions of people who had been diagnosed by the checklist as disordered went to psychiatrists to be medicated. The result was liberation from anxiety on a wide scale. But in the process, the checklist became a powerful and seemingly objective guide for people as to what should be their normal feelings and what was abnormal. And a number of leading psychiatrists began to argue that what they were actually doing was creating a static society in which human beings were adjusted by the medication so they fitted to an agreed normal type defined by the checklist.
People come to me all the time asking me to medicate them. The implication behind that was that human beings, like all other animals, have a particular ideal model. It had a machine-like quality to it. We know what the model should be. And they asked the medications, they asked of me to give them medications that would push them back to this particular model they have. An unrealistic model, but a very static model of man as machine.
Has it worked? You look very dubious, my friend.
Apparently it has. I can't help being suspicious of it. I don't think she's the woman I married.
Why?
I think she's changed.
In what way?
I don't know, but there's something there that is different.
Okay, she's not the woman you married. Is she a better woman?
No, she's different.
They imagined that they might live in a world where there would never be a worry, not even a grief, where never did conflict, concern, worry over alternatives make possible the kinds of progress that we've seen in the past.
But then, the man who had created the checklist system admitted that it might actually be leading millions of people to believe that they were disordered when they were not. The checklists added up only observable symptoms. They deliberately excluded any understanding of the patient's life. Because of this, he said, it confused genuine psychological disorder with normal human feelings of sadness and anxiety, and that this was happening on a wide scale. All this was being said by one of America's most powerful psychiatrists, Dr. Robert Spitzer.
What happened is that we made estimates of prevalence of mental disorders totally descriptively, without considering that many of these conditions might be normal reactions, which are not really disorders. That's the problem, because we were not looking at the context in which those conditions developed.
So you have effectively medicalized much of ordinary human sadness, fear, ordinary experiences. You've medicalized them.
I think we have, to some extent. How serious a problem it is not known. I don't know if it's 20%, 30%, I don't know. But that's a considerable amount if it is 20 or 30%.
What was happening was that large parts of normal human experience, grief, disappointment, loneliness, were all being reclassified as medical disorders. In the process, a new system of management was emerging. The drugs took away those complex and difficult feelings and made the individuals happier. But they also made them simpler beings, more easy to predict and manage, and closer to the machine-like creatures at the heart of the economic models.
By using checklists of symptoms about emotions, you have gone out and confused normal human responses to life with mental disorder, and therefore created an illusion of a vast epidemic, a medicalized illusion. And obviously a situation where you medicalize is a situation where your focus will not be on social change, it will be on controlling individuals to fit in properly. That's the subtle and overall danger here, that it could serve our kind of social economic systems needs in a way in which we become more efficient, but less human.
What the psychiatrists had discovered was that an objective system based on numbers had led them into a trap. The numbers had imposed their own narrow logic on how we thought and felt about ourselves. And the politicians were about to find that their attempts to manage society by using numbers would also have the strangest consequences. Far from helping them achieve their progressive vision, they would actually make society more rigid and even harder to change. In 1997, New Labour was elected. What it promised was a society free of the arrogance and prejudices of the old elites who had dominated Britain's class system for so long.
It is us, the new radicals, a Labour Party modernised, that must undertake this historic mission to liberate Britain from all the old class divisions, old structures, old prejudices, old ways of working and of doing things that will not do in this world of change.
Throughout their campaign, New Labour had modelled themselves on the Clinton Democrats. And now in power, they did exactly what Clinton had done. They gave power away to the banks and the markets. Gordon Brown's first announcement was to abandon the politicians' final lever of control over the economy.
The new Chancellor, Gordon Brown, announces a revolution in economic policy. From now on, the Chancellor will hand control of interest rates to an independent Bank of England.
And in the management of society, New Labour turned to the mathematical systems that John Major had brought in, but on a scale never seen before. They believed that people actually behaved in the way described by the simplified economic model. Performance targets and incentives would be set for everything and everyone. Even cabinet ministers would have to fulfil their performance targets or be punished.
300 or so performance targets, over 150 efficiency targets. Each public service agreement will have a named minister who is responsible for delivering and achieving those targets. They may not have to resign, but they will have to explain why they haven't been able to meet their targets. If a department fails to meet those targets, then it's only right and proper that government will look seriously at their ability to deliver.
The Treasury, under Gordon Brown, created a vast mathematical system. They invented ways of giving numerical values to things that previously no one thought could be measured. Hunger in sub-Saharan Africa was to be reduced to below 48%, while world conflict was to be reduced by 6%. and all the towns and villages in Britain were to be measured for a community vibrancy index. And even the quality of life in the countryside was broken down into a series of indices, one of which measured how much birdsong there should be.
We want a barometer of the indicators of the quality of life, and they're not simply the economic ones. Half of the skylarks have gone since 1970. Now, if you want to measure the quality of the life, one of the things is that dawn chorus. It's about indices that affect everybody in a quality of a life barometer.
The original idea behind the mathematical system was that it would liberate public servants from old forms of bureaucratic control. Once they were given the targets, they were free to achieve them any way they wanted. But almost immediately, New Labour began to discover that people were more complex and devious than the simple model allowed. Public servants began to find the most ingenious ways of hitting their targets.
It's about the pressure to meet these targets. It's causing some NHS managers to game the system.
Hospital managers proved to be particularly devious. When they were set targets to cut waiting lists, they ordered consultants to do the easiest operations first, like bunions and vasectomies. Complicated ones, like cancers, were no longer prioritised. And they found other clever ways of getting people off the lists.
What happened at this hospital is truly shocking. Administrators wrote to patients asking them when they'd be on holiday. They then used that information to set the timing of the operation, knowing that the patients would be away. As a result, the patients did not get their operations, but the hospital managed to cut its waiting lists.
And when the managers were set a target to reduce waiting times in casualty, they came up with more clever strategies. A new job was invented called the hello nurse, who did nothing to treat the patient, but simply greeting them meant they had been seen and were off the list. When the government then tried to set a target to reduce the number of patients waiting on trolleys, the managers took the wheels off the trolleys and reclassified them as beds. And they redefined the corridors as walls. And yet again, the patients were off the list. The police were also under pressure to meet their targets. One of the main ones was to reduce the rate of recorded crime. Again, inventive strategies were found. Lothian police announced the most successful crime figures in 25 years. But it was later found that they had reclassified hundreds of crimes, including assault, robbery and fire-raising, as simply suspicious occurrences, which wouldn't be included in the figures.
We are passionate about meeting these targets.
Fiddling.
By the management.
Altered their records.
But that's a bit odd. I mean, you're the consultant.
And started to amend some of the answers that the youngsters had given.
Trolley weights, none.
Targets, three levels of targets.
Clear targets, targets, those targets. And focus on those targets. Why they targets, targets.
The government tried to dismiss these reports as just a few bad examples. But report after report came out, which revealed that this inventive gaming of the system was now endemic throughout the public services. What was supposed to be a rational system was instead creating a strange world in which no one knew whether to believe the numbers or not. The government's response was to introduce even more mathematical levels of management. Complex systems of auditing were created to monitor workers and make sure they fulfilled the targets in the correct way. What had begun as a system of liberation was turning into a powerful system of control.
If I don't hit those targets, then I don't get a pay increase. It's as simple as that.
They withhold your increment?
They withhold my increment.
Not meeting the targets is really not an option.
It's such an important target that I get to keep my job this month because there's no red on the screen.
If they don't reach the targets, they're axed, and if they speak out against them, they're axed. We here have a catch-22 situation.
If you get zero-star rated, you are being watched like a hawk.
So, I think you should go.
But the numbers were also having a strange and perverse effect on New Labour's vision of a freer and more open Britain. They were, in fact, creating a more rigid and stratified society. At the heart of this was education and the league tables for schools. The tables showed parents which were the best-performing schools and which were the worst ones. The government said that this would incentivise the less successful ones to compete and improve their services, and standards would then rise across the country. In fact, the very opposite happened. Rich parents moved into the areas of the best schools, which then caused house prices to spiral, keeping the poor out. And nearly all schools taught their pupils only those narrow facts they would need to answer in exams, and so would help the schools rise up the league tables. What was lost was the wider education that would help the poorer children rise up in society. In 2006, a series of reports made it clear that there was a definite link between the government's policies in education and the rise of social segregation based on wealth. This has contributed to a much wider problem. Social mobility in Britain has now ground to a halt. The stark fact is that the children of rich families in Britain today are much more likely to live and die rich than in the recent past, while children from poor families are more likely to live and die poor. The country has become more rigid and stratified than at any time since the Second World War. New Labour had adopted the market model of freedom, believing that there would be a trade-off. They gave up their old political role of intervening in the market to reduce inequality, but what was supposed to follow was a new openness and fluidity in society. In fact, they now have the worst of both worlds. Society has become more rigid, while the inequalities have become more extreme. Under New Labour, the country is even more unequal than it was under Mrs. Thatcher, with an ever-increasing share of the wealth going to a tiny 1% at the top of society. And the inequalities not only affect how you live, but also when you will die. Across the country, differences in life expectancy have increased since 1997. And inequalities in child mortality by class have also increased. A baby born in Hackney is now twice as likely to die in its first year as a baby born in Bexley. Beneath the meritocratic surface, the social class divisions in Britain are hardening and deepening. And in America, throughout the 1990s, the economic model of democracy was leading not just to the rise of inequality, but to financial and political corruption on a huge scale. America had experienced a spectacular market boom, but those running the market had realized that the numbers were not telling the truth, because the giant accounting firms had become corrupted.
There was a new element afoot, the very foundation of the market. The numbers that represented the sanctity of the market, the reliability of the market, were becoming unreliable because the accountants had violated the trust the government had placed in them. I knew that the great accounting firms of America had engaged in practices that were very, very questionable and very often fraudulent. We were seeing more and more and more of these cases.
How widespread did it become?
Extremely widespread.
Those who ran many of America's corporations were faking profits on an enormous scale. They did this because it would then increase their personal bonuses.
Come on, they would say, isn't there another way of looking at those numbers? Can we compromise? Can we spread, for example, this misrepresentation over a number of years? In all of these cases, the effect is one of corruption. We were trusted. We had a rational system based on numbers that could not be disputed. We ended up now with a fictitious, irrational system.
The officials, whose job was to regulate the market, tried to persuade politicians in Congress to act and expose this, but they were blocked at every turn. They found that all the key politicians were being given millions of dollars in campaign contributions by both the corporations and the accounting firms.
I mean, massive amounts of money were spent in lobbying committees of Congress. I knew they were motivated by concern for business interests.
You mean they've been bribed?
No. I wouldn't use that word. That's your word.
What word would you use?
Seduced.
Despite the growing evidence of corruption, the Clinton administration portrayed the boom as something revolutionary. It was a genuine democracy of the marketplace in which everyone at all levels of society was benefiting. But this was completely untrue. If one compares the incomes of Americans in real terms between the end of the 1970s and the end of the 1990s, those at the bottom of society saw their income actually fall. Those in the middle saw a slight increase, while those at the top increased by an extraordinary amount.
If you take income after taxes, you find that the average household cash income in the bottom fifth of Americans went from $9,300 a year to $8,700. You find that the average household cash income in the middle fifth, the median, went from about $31,800 to $33,200. You take the top 1% in the same time period, you go from $256,000 a year to $644,000 a year. That, to me, is the simplest set of numbers I can use to sum it all up. I have many variations, but those just eat right out of the box at you. It's just incredible how you can have something like that.
Underlying the political experiments of the 1990s had been a simplified idea of human beings, that at heart they were just self-seeking individuals whose needs could be best met through the marketplace, not politics. If left unregulated, the markets would benefit everyone. In the face of this simple, irresistible argument, politicians had given away much of their power. But what had actually happened was the return of inequalities and social injustices not seen for 100 years. The very thing politicians were supposed to prevent. Politicians now found themselves weakened and corrupted, and without the power to change society. And millions of individuals were left without representation and even less control over their lives.
Here is the ultimate irony, because as people began to believe they are just self-seeking, acquisitive individuals, that the democratic systems are fundamentally not nearly as good as the market for fulfilling whatever it is you want, people allowed elites to take over politics and politics to be distorted and corrupted, so that politics became even less capable of fulfilling people's needs. And meanwhile, the market did not give people good jobs, secure jobs. And so ultimately, the individual cannot be fulfilled either through politics or through the market.
What had given the simplified view of human beings much of its power had been ideas drawn from both mathematics and biology. As this program has shown, it underpinned a powerful model of ourselves as almost computer-like machines, whose instincts had largely been encoded within them millions of years before. But now, questions were beginning to be asked in the scientific world about whether this was too simple a view of human beings. In genetics, the idea that the DNA is the all-controlling set of instructions for life has been replaced by a more complex idea. Scientists have shown that a cell actually chooses and edits which parts of the DNA to use, depending on the environmental forces acting on it. One of the key experiments that showed that the self-interested actions of genes control behaviour has also been questioned. Anthropologists looked into the history of the Yanomamo tribes and discovered a pattern to their violence that could be explained by very different causes than genes. It only seemed to happen when the Yanomamo came into contact with Westerners who gave them goods. The tribes fought with each other for access to those goods.
What I discovered was that there was a pattern in which the warfare became more intense, or happened at all, during times of greater Western penetration into the area. You're not going to get any help by looking at their reproductive striving. I think what will explain that for you is what is the historical interactions with these powerful outside forces. That explains when and where they fight.
And those powerful outside forces are what?
The powerful outside forces are predominantly the Westerners who come in who are sources of these much-desired goods.
Anthropologists have looked again at the film of the axe fight. They argue that what one actually sees is a struggle between two factions. One, a group who have been given machetes by the filmmaker, Napoleon Chagnon. The other, a group of visitors to the village who are refusing to leave because they too want access to these precious gifts. The real cause of the fight, they say, is not the genes, but a struggle of politics and power aggravated by the filmmaker himself. But Chagnon completely disagrees and stands by his experiment.
No, I don't think the axe fight happened because I was there.
You sure?
Well, are you sure your father's your father? I think it would be a reasonable presumption that this axe fight would have happened whether or not I was there. And the very fact that I was there and documented it was not the cause of it. Because axe fights or club fights happen in many other villages when I'm not there. And I've documented these as well through informants who describe them. So I don't think this particular fight was anything extraordinary and out of the pattern of Yanomami violence.
You don't think a film crew in the middle of a fight in a village has an effect?
No, I don't. That's the end of my interview.
And in mathematics, the man who had created the equations that lay behind the simplified economic model of society was also expressing doubts about the assumptions on which his work had been based. He was the mathematician John Nash. Nash, who has now recovered from paranoid schizophrenia and still works at Princeton, has come to believe that the purely rational, calculating creatures in his model, what he calls the human as businessman, have little connection with the complexity of real human beings.
I have had some trouble myself on the psychological level. I've been in mental hospitals, and so I have... I may be developing a pattern of rationality. I realize that what I had said at some time may have overemphasized rationality or some type of thinking, and I don't want to overemphasize rational thinking on the part of humans. Human beings are much more complicated than like the human being as a businessman. Human behavior is not entirely motivated by self-interest of each pure human.
But the underlying assumption of game theory is that it is.
Game theory works in terms of self-interest. But it was like the viewpoint that some game theory concepts could be unsound. There's over-dependence on rationality. That is my enlightenment.
And Nash is not alone. In economics, the whole idea that the free market is an efficient system is coming under serious attack. Over the past 5 years, many of the Nobel Prizes for economics have been awarded for research that shows that markets do not create stability or order. That what Adam Smith called the invisible hand is invisible because it isn't actually there. And politicians do have a powerful role to play in controlling the markets. And a new discipline called behavioural economics has been studying whether people really do behave as the simplified model says they do. Their studies show that only two groups in society actually behave in a rational, self-interested way in all experimental situations. One is economists themselves. The other is psychopaths.
Is that all there is? Is that all there is?
The final part of The Trap is next Sunday at 9. Next tonight, Combat Opera do their own personal take on binge drinking here on BBC Two. And on BBC Four, 70 years on and very little changed, Design Classics takes a look at the tube map.
If that's all there is. We'll be right back.
in danger when you're walking down the street you're alone. So disregard the bombings you heard that happened last night by the second circle. It has a precaution, keep your vigilance high. The secret agent strikes at any time. Turn on your friends, turn on yourself. You got no power, but living is something. The secret agent is free to conquer, walking around with a bomb in his hand. Hear bombs falling. This killer of men living out his calling. Symptomatic of how we live our life. This river of trust is running dry. Turn on your friends, turn on yourself. You got more power than living in nothing. Secret agent, he's got a weapon. Taking matters into his own head. I'm about to take a look. Oh!
Laat heel hard van je horen. There's no intention of doing what's expected. God is the connected. Yearning for more, I'm impatient. Got nothing to lose, wanna chase it. Trusting him, believing in it. No one, they all be there in it. But every now and then, when no one's around, I slide into my mind. Drifting away in my sleep, leaving it lost in a dream. When I wake up, I just wanna be back in a fantasy. Don't wanna leave yet, I know that I should. Open my eyes and I'm back to the truth. I'd rather be stuck in a daydream. Giving me a chance, let me prove you are wrong. Telling me get down from the clouds, but I won't. I know I'm in a place where I belong. The practice I need, but I'm tired of waiting. Don't wanna lose the hope, afraid of taking that risk. Yearning for more, I'm impatient. Got nothing to lose, wanna chase it. Trusting and believing in it, no one day I'll be there in it. But every now and then, when no one's around, I slide. Up, I just wanna be back in a fantasy. Don't wanna leave yet, I know that I should. Open my eyes and I'm back to the